From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on November 17th, 2016, at the University of Oxford Business School in England. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg was discussing the nature of work and the impact of income inequality. And he began by highlighting what he feels are significant gains when it comes to worldwide poverty, life expectancy, disease, and other outcomes. But Bloomberg was not as optimistic about what he calls educational inequality. He explained his view that the nature of work has changed, and he pointed out that long ago, most jobs were farming or agricultural in nature, and today a small percentage of jobs fit that description. Then Bloomberg made some remarks that have resurfaced this week. He explained that with farming, it was easy work, easy to teach, anyone could do it. But the world has changed, he explained, and modern jobs require more brain power. He said that information technology requires higher level thinking and analysis. Critics from all sides attacked these remarks as being ignorant about the challenge of farming and the nature of work. The Bloomberg campaign has said he was taken out of context. We'll discuss that coming up. We've heard from a number of local farmers about these remarks, and we're taking the opportunity to talk about them at length. And my guests this hour include a guy who's not only a farmer, but he's talked about AI, which I guess Matt Kelly, I don't know if the Bloomberg campaign knew that you could do both.
I'm not sure they did either, but thanks for having me here today.
He's an independent journalist. He's the creator of TheBReport.com and a member of the Hunt family and the team that owns and operates Hunt Country Vineyards. A lot of farming in his background. A lot of farming in Ruth Blackwell's background as well, the owner of Mud Creek Farm CSA. Welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Christopher Misick is here. Chris is the owner and winemaker for Belangelo. They manage and farm 7 acres down on Seneca Lake. So you've been a farmer for how many years now?
Well, we started winemaking back in 2011. We planted our first vineyard about 2 years ago.
Thanks for making the trip up here. In fact, all of our guests today, I think, put some miles in to get here. We appreciate that. Listeners, if you want to join the program, you can do that various ways this hour. It's connections at WXXI.org, and it's 844-295-TALK. If you want to call the program toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'd like to listen to Bloomberg's remarks first off, if we could, and for a little bit of context here, to be fair here, what I want to do is point out that you're going to hear about a 50 or so second clip here. You know, we're always trying to be careful about getting the context right here. And he is talking about what he described as the way the agrarian society used to be and how it has transitioned. So these are some of his remarks there following some of his opening remarks that, you know, for 300 years of an industrial society, you had a chance to employ a lot of people in what he thought were pretty simple ways. Let's listen.
Anybody, even people in this room, so no offense intended, to be a farmer. It's a process. You dig a hole, you put a seed in, you put dirt on top, add water, up comes the corn. Then we had 300, you could learn that. Then you have 300 years of the industrial society. You put the piece of metal on the lathe, you turn the crank and the direction of the arrow, and you can have a job. And we created a lot of jobs. 1.98% of the world worked in agriculture. Today, it's 2% in the United States. Now comes the information economy. And the information economy is fundamentally different because it's built around replacing people with technology. And the skill sets that you have to learn are how to think and analyze. And that is a whole degree level different. You have to have a different skill set. You have to have a lot more gray matter.
All right, Ruth Blackwell. Why don't you start, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the context. But what comes to mind first as you listen to those remarks?
I think he probably lost a bunch of middle America right there. I mean, I don't know. I think he put his foot in his mouth. He probably wasn't thinking about running for president at that point. But I think it's pretty insulting to most farmers to assume that we don't need a lot of gray matter. And I think he seems to think he knows enough about it to speak about it. He doesn't even know what he doesn't know about farming, like how much we need to know, how much we need to know about a lot of different things. And even for me, I mean, I'm pretty small scale, so a lot of the processes I'm using, a lot of my equipment is not even the new fancy technology. I mean, I'm driving cultivating tractors from the 40s. You need to know a lot about that stuff.
Can I say not just sort of appeasing the three guests in the room, but I think if I had to take over farming operations for a while, we would probably starve for a while. I don't think it's as simple as dropping a seed in the ground, covering it with dirt and watching it grow. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But Ruth, just as a follow-up, the Bloomberg campaign has said, look, he was talking about what farming used to be like. He's not talking about, which, by the way, the rejoinder to that would be, well, shouldn't he have qualified that modern farming is a lot more technical with a lot more decision-making that goes into it and a lot more education? But he was saying that's what it used to be. He's not talking about now. Does that change the context there for you at all?
No, because, I mean, our country was built by people, you know, scraping by agriculturally on really tough land, figuring out how to, you know, survive. And the amount of ingenuity and brain power that came and you know, stick-to-itiveness that came from our pioneer ancestors is pretty impressive. I mean, I'd love to see Mike Bloomberg try and control a team of oxen, right?
Ingenuity and education expertise even hundreds of years ago. But Matt Kelly, do you hear anything in there that says, these are a little out of context, the public response has been a little unfair?
You know, I don't know if the public response has been unfair. I think we're absolutely right to want to put this in context, but what I also think is important is the idea that a snippet like this really reveals insight into how somebody is thinking. Mm-hmm. So he could have made the same point, and you just said this, he could have made the same point in the same amount of time in a very different way, right? Because for me, the issue isn't to say that it requires more gray matter to be successful in the information economy shows an outdated understanding of intelligence and gray matter. I mean, I guess that's the irony. He's really not showing gray matter about gray matter. I think what it requires is the same level of intelligence applied in a different way. And so it's very telling that he thinks that the world that he seems to understand and that we're moving into requires more intelligence than a world he doesn't really understand and that he's not familiar with.
Chris Misick, as I turn to you, I want to mention to our listeners, you might see Chris's name as someone running for office. This is not a campaign conversation. But my view as a journalist and a talk show host is that, especially in election years, I think people running for office should be sort of in the public discourse more often and not less. That having been said, I reached out to your opponent, let her know you're on the program today. Chris is running for state senate. I said I want to make sure she has equal time to talk about issues that are sort of in her field of expertise, which we're going to do soon. And then ideally, we'll bring you together for the election at least once, maybe multiple times. But I just want listeners to know, if you see his name, our view on people running for office, we like you on the program more and not less. We want to do it as equally as we possibly can, and that's that. But we'll talk to campaign on a different day. Fair?
That sounds great, Evan.
All right, very good. So let's talk about your thought, your first reaction to the clip that you heard there.
Yeah, I would say I had two. One, you know, especially farming, anything that requires labor, and this goes out into kind of that whole array of blue-collar jobs. It's not just learning that skill or that trade. It's a state of mind that you have to have when you do that kind of work. And that state of mind isn't just a specialty or knowing what that job is. It's having the ability to sweat it out, to have your back hurt, to have your knees hurt. It's a whole body experience. And I think that when we have somebody like Bloomberg, and you know, I want to say it's not just about him. It's about a mindset that I think has poisoned a lot of the country, who looks down at the snowplow driver who helped make sure I could get here today, the person who's inspecting the sewers to make sure when we flush that toilet, that waste goes away. I think it's endemic of an entire mindset that we need to focus on changing.
All right, so let me ask all of you, and I'll start with Chris on this. Do you feel, generally speaking, that too many decision makers in this country are disconnected from work, especially work that involves physical labor?
Absolutely. There is something that happens in your spirit, in your soul, when you're actually working with not just your mind, but your body. It connects you to the land. It connects you to your coworkers in entirely different ways. I mean, just as an example, we're out pounding 7,000 posts, training new vines just this last summer. And it's not like that's the only thing that's going on. I'm having fantastic conversations with my coworkers. We're talking about everything from the Varsity Blues scandal last summer to I mean, esoteric religious ideas. You know, what happens when you work with your hands? What happens when you work with your whole body? It's a different experience. It's rewarding. And I think it connects us to communities more than almost any other thing we can do.
Okay. Matt Kelly?
Yeah, I think what it also demonstrates is a real lack of understanding about the human experience. I think that this idea that we are exclusively intellectual creatures and that's the best thing to be is ridiculous.
Or even the hardest thing to be.
Or even the hardest thing to be, absolutely. We know for a fact that physical activity improves intellectual ability and capacities. These things are not separate. They're not disconnected. Humans need to be doing both to excel at whatever we want to do.
And I think that sort of leads into this question where we're in a society today where unfortunately so many of us lack that sort of physical experience. And what do we see? We see more depression. We see more isolation. We see a sadder society.
Ruth, do you think the decision makers too often are disconnected from physical work?
I think so. I think they also, it's that mindset again. But I think a lot of people who have gone into that kind of work, politicians, present company excluded, have never had to interact with a farmer. You know, there's such a disconnect between the food we eat and where it comes from. I think a lot of people don't understand what goes into farming, that a farmer needs to know about genetics and soil science. And there's a lot of things that go into it. It's not just a physical job. And that's the same with a lot of physical jobs. But there's this sort of mindset that it's either a physical job or an intellectual job. Not that it takes all. Yeah. It takes all of it.
And so before we start cycling through feedback, we already have a lot. Two other points here. Can all three of you in a short sort of your quick menu of things that come to mind when people say, what's the hardest part of the decision making, the challenge of the job, both the intellectual and physical, but really sort of the gray matter part of farming, if we're going to use the phrase. Ruth, what's top of the list for you?
Well, for me, I mean, I grow a very large number of different kinds of things because I'm a CSA. So I need to have quite a bit of variety in what I grow. So a lot of the intellectual part for me is crop planning, rotation, so that I avoid carrying diseases from one plant species to another, timing, so that I have the right amount of the right things in each share throughout the season. A lot of planning goes into it because there's a lot of complicated moving parts. Plus then weather never wants to cooperate. So then thinking on your feet and changing plans so that everything still works out. That's probably most of, you know, I try and write everything down, but my tendency is to keep it all in my brain. And if I don't write it down enough, I start losing sleep. But yeah, that's what's going through my brain most of the time.
I was checking the files. You were last on this program in December of 2018 when we were talking about purchasing wasps in the mail.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm also organic, so I have to think about all the different ways to take care of diseases and pests without just spraying things and killing everything. So yeah, parasitic wasps, that's part of what I'm thinking about most of the time.
Yeah. I think of parasitic wasps when I'm having a nightmare. You do it as a clever way of approaching your craft.
Matt, didn't we win you over?
You actually did.
They
to
were
tiny.
They're tiny and
I'm
they
not
going to
call them
you.
Cute.
They're cute.
I'm not going to call them cute, but you won me over on them. Matt?
Second vote for cute. I'm in the cute camp on this.
Of course you are, Mr. B Report.
There you go. So this is also where I think we can start really seeing how you can't draw these sort of monolithic sort of descriptions of any sort of group of people in this country, because even as we talk about farming and the challenges of the gray matter in farming, you know, Ruth is doing annual crops where grapes are perennial crops. So even that gets into a whole different realm of how you plan and respond to things. But I think, you know, from my perspective, because I am not one of the people that is out in the vineyard every day, you know, what strikes me as being the hardest sort of intellectual challenge of farming for grapes is the strategy of it, because it's a long-term game, right? So it's not annual. We're not having to, you know, growth. We're not regrowing new things every year. We're dealing with the same crops that have been established for, in some cases, 100 years. And so how do we strategize around that? What wines do we release? Because you have to let wines ferment for a period of time. How long do you let them ferment? What do you release when? Is it good enough to put in a bottle? If this one isn't, what do you do? What are the other things? So it's a long-term strategy game. And then in the moment, there's the tactics of it. How do I respond at this moment with this decision when I only have 2 weeks to make a call on something?
I have been in the winery during harvest when grapes are coming in and just looking at all the tanks and barrels and trying to figure out what has to move, what has to go where. And I'm thinking the math involved in just that nearly broke my brain, and all I had to do was sort for like ladybugs. So that, yeah, not fun. I mean, I'd say I'm sure it is fun for some. I'm glad that you do it because I don't think I could, Chris.
And that's important work because you do not want those methoxypyrazines in your wine. So.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I break it from the farming aspect into two different areas. We have the intensive preparation of choosing what we're going to plant, where we're going to plant it, site selection, the cation exchange ratio of the soils in terms of how they're going to take up water, how they're going to take up minerals and nutrients. And then you have the yearly battle of what nature brings you. Now, we're a no-herbicide farm. We do that because we care about our environment and we want to keep glyphosate out of the water source, which is right there, Seneca Lake. And so that means more work for us and different sprays. So, you know, I have a grower who likes to say when you're farming, you can either coach a hockey game or you can, you know, conduct a symphony. And we like to conduct symphonies, but sometimes it's not always that easy. At the end of the day, these are just two of the small considerations in value-added agriculture that, you know, the elite of the elite like Bloomberg just doesn't understand because he doesn't do that work.
So the last question before I turn it over to some listeners is this. At least let's try to take up sort of the Bloomberg position, which he might say, look, all I'm saying is, in the same way that Andrew Yang made the case for UBI, we are entering a world every day more and more in which the jobs that used to exist for people are going to be automated. And we have decisions about what that means and how challenging that's going to be. And that's the point I was trying to make, however clumsy. Is that fair? Does he have a claim there, Chris?
You know, I go back and forth on this topic. It's clear technology's, you know, advancing. And I got to be honest, first 10 years of this millennia, I loved Ray Kurzweil and, you know, talked about the singularity.
Yeah.
But I listen a lot to guys like Eric Weinstein, to guys like Peter Thiel and Tyler Cohen. And, you know, what they have to say is, if you stand in a living room today, it's not that different from 1970, except for a cell phone and internet connection. When you compare 1970 to 1920, life was drastically different. Things are changing. Things are advancing. But we need to have people who learn to develop those skills that can work in a changing economy. And I don't think it's going to change as fast as Andrew Yang thinks it's going to. You know, we've got a lot of work to do in training up our workforce. We've got a lot of work to do in understanding economic conditions and how they'll change. Mechanization plays an important part. But as these changes happen, you know what we need, Evan? We need connections. We need to be able to relate to other people. And that's why value-added agriculture, like all of us at this table do, is one way to build that and one way to kind of find new sectors of the economy to grow those changes.
Matt, does Bloomberg have a case to say, even if it was clumsy, this was really about the changing economy?
Yeah, I think he definitely has a case. And this, I guess this is where I would disagree a little bit. I think it's going to happen much faster than we expect it to happen. And I think even though the living rooms between 1970 and today don't look different, I think in many ways they functionally are. And that's why the change is going to sneak up on us so fast, because it will be happening in hidden ways. And this gets us back to conversations about artificial intelligence and how things just kind of seep in through, how things can seep in, how the changes can seep in through the through an appearance that we already have.
You want to add more of that, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think a really good example is driving, you know, self-driving vehicles. We have a lot of that technology today. You know, the one of the greatest job sectors for especially men who haven't gone to college is trucking. One of the greatest job sectors, especially for females, would be, you know, service jobs. And we do have ways where that's taking over. But you know what? I don't think we're going to be reaching a point within the next 5 years where especially interstate trucking doesn't require someone to be in the vehicle. A lot of this depends on what happens on higher levels, on what the federal government even allows, and where we go with 5G and 6G, all of these things. I think that we are in a place where we will adapt, but we need to be cognizant of how we adapt. And we need to make sure that we have an education system in place that helps make sure that happens.
I got to say, too, some of the most up all night, persistent, talented truck drivers I know are women, too.
Well, that, too. Yeah. Just statistics. I wasn't.
Yeah. No, I hear that. But before I turn to Ruth or Matt, do you feel like there's a gap between where you and Chris are and where automation's going?
No, I mean, ultimately, I agree. I think the bottom line is we need to be thoughtful about the change. Mm-hmm. And if that's the argument that Bloomberg is making, I'm happy to have that argument, right? I'm happy to have that discussion. I just think we can do it a little more eloquently and inclusively.
I agree.
Okay. Ruth?
I agree. It could be more inclusive. I think that he probably alienated a lot of people who are already using a lot of technology. I mean, you think about big monocrop farms out west, they're already using tractors that are being controlled by GPS. There's no person in it. And farmers probably understand about self-driving cars a little better than him, honestly. But, I mean, there's also a lot of different ways to farm, and I think automation and new technologies are going to be really important in the coming years, especially when it comes to climate change. For me, I'm a small local farm, partially because of the climate impact that our food economy already has. A lot of the problems with the food economy now is there's the average number of miles your food travels from the farm to your plate is like 1,500 miles. So I think smaller, diversified organic farms are going to really help in the future in that way. And I definitely use some automation already. I mean, I use a lot of apps that help me crop plan and just communicate with my employees. But at this point, I still need hands in the dirt.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds to me, Matt Kelly, like she's using the AI tools that make the human job easier without replacing the human.
Exactly.
To go back to a theme from a previous discussion.
Yeah, and I think that, for me, that's exactly where I would want to be. Like, if we're talking about the transition and being thoughtful about the transition, that's exactly where we want to be. And that's also where I would come back to our original discussion about, does it require more intelligence to do that? No, it requires the same amount of intelligence applied in a new way.
Mm-hmm. Another point about that, I use this app that's been developed in the last few years called Tend, which is designed for a small market farmer or a small CSA farmer that's extremely helpful, saves a lot of my time in planning and saves a lot of resources just from avoiding mistakes because my employees have a place to look something up and check it off. But the people who designed that application know how to farm, and they would not have been able to design it if they didn't understand all the things that go into a farm. Mm-hmm. And they're talking with farmers about it to help them design it better.
Well, wait after our only break. Wait till you hear some of the feedback. I'm very curious to get our guest's take on that. And if you're on the phone, hang there. Nancy will come to you in just a second. The emails are pretty remarkable as we talk about Michael Bloomberg's comments about farming, yes, but also the nature of work, the changing nature of work. And you just heard Ruth Blackwell, who's the owner of Mud Creek Farm CSA. Matt Kelly is an independent journalist, the creator of TheBeeReport.com, and a member of the Hunt family and the team that owns and operates Hunt Country Vineyards. Christopher Misick is the owner and winemaker at Belangelo on Seneca Lake. And that feedback from you is next. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with Xinpei Sei, the Director of Policy, Cities, and Transportation for Uber. She's worked in a number of American cities on issues facing our urban future and transportation. That's the title of her talk next week in Rochester. She's coming as part of the Reshaping Rochester series to talk about a sustainable urban future through transportation. So what should we expect when it comes to changes and how we get around? That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's cycle through some of the feedback. First of all, This person says, please do not use my name. I continue to try not to insult my family. So just from B. These are the first things said to me as a farmer by some of my in-laws when they met me. Quote, farmers are dumb. Anybody can be a farmer. No questions, no curiosity about something with which they had no knowledge, education, or experience. B, sorry to hear that. I think that's farther than Michael Bloomberg went, but that sort of depends on, you want Matt Kelly?
I really do, because I'm sure, I understand farmers said that to B.
No, B is a farmer.
B is a farmer.
And someone in the family, new in-laws, said, oh, you're a farmer? Farmers are dumb. Anybody can do that.
I'm sorry. You know what's interesting? As I heard her saying, her farmer in-laws said that to her.
No.
But here's a point I also want to make as just having that said. Anybody could say that about anybody in any profession. I mean, literally. Anybody could say that about anybody in any profession. So
there's clearly a dumb billionaire out there.
One or two, I would bet. Yeah.
We have this idea that if you've made $1 billion, you can do anything. You're qualified to do anything.
Yeah, but how many people... Am I on? How many people out there who made $1 billion made it? Like, a lot of billionaires are just handed it.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Well, back to the phones we go. This is Nancy calling from North Rose. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Hello. I am a small organic grower out in North Rose in Wayne County. And when I heard this statement made by Bloomberg, I just about smacked myself in the head. Because he really has a lot to learn about farming. Obviously, he doesn't really know anything about it. What it requires today to be able to sustain food accessibility and growing is a much more holistic approach. We have to look at history. How indigenous peoples were able to sustain their food sources and notice the patterns of the rise and fall of civilizations related to agriculture, how those patterns reveal the harvesting over, many decades or centuries, where soil depletion caused the decline and failure of entire civilizations. Those patterns reoccur. Industrialization and technology can be useful tools, but they can also be overused. And to think that that alone is going to solve our food problem around the world is a big mistake. The powers of the human mind have all of them, all aspects, the power of observation, intuition, and deep questioning are all employed to be able to gain some wisdom from what nature exhibits all the time in her natural systems, if there are any left for us to observe. We have so much to learn, and we all understand as small organic growers that there's so much more that we don't know that has yet to be discovered and understood, and that only by applying a really wide, full view can we ever imagine being able to be successful and sustainable in the human race on this planet.
Well, Nancy, let me just jump in here and say, first of all, thank you for the phone call. And Nancy's phone call, I think, highlights something that, again, I'm going to make this point without trying to sort of sound like I'm pandering, but some of the smartest people I know work in farming, work in agriculture, work with their hands, work in the soil. And Nancy's point, and I'll get our guest's take on this, is that we have to be careful to assume that automation is actually going to solve food supply issues, because we still need that thoughtful approach, knowing your land, knowing processes, knowing you know, sort of how to solve these complex problems of food systems, of which farming is obviously intricately tied. You agree, Chris?
I totally agree. And, you know, my personal biography, I was a lawyer. I left all that for agriculture because this is where my passion really was. And one of my growers, one of the people I work with, I buy grapes from Alfred, developed reticulated ceramics, a genius, sold that company for millions, went into farming. Over and over, we see that happen. We do need to make sure, though, that sustainability is a key. That's why I talk about protecting our water. That's why we practice cover crops. That's why we do all of those things. And she makes a really good point. You know, we need to take the inspiration from our indigenous population as well. What they were able to carve out, the civilization they were able to build before, unfortunately, that got wiped out, it should be an inspiration for us.
Okay. Matt Kelly?
Yeah, I think I would agree that automation and technology and the information economy as it is currently kind of conceived and accepted is not going to be the solution to meeting the food needs of the future. However, going back to a very simple example like Ruth gave, an app designed by farmers for farmers is working out pretty well. Mm-hmm. If we include the right people, if we are thoughtful enough to be inclusive in how we create these new technologies and automate things and bring artificial intelligence into it, I think it'll have immense and extraordinarily helpful solutions for us.
Okay, Ruth, you want to add to that?
Yeah, automation and technology definitely have their place in agriculture. I mean, they already have. And I think that it's just very important to make sure that it's implemented in the right way and not the wrong way. It has its place. I think that making the job easier for people is really that place. But she's right. You know, a big part of being a farmer and a successful farmer is being constantly observant of everything that's going on around you on your land to the minutest detail. And that's how you catch what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that's how you learn from the earth how to be successful and work with it as opposed to work against it.
Okay. Matt, you want to add to that?
I do. And I don't want to take the conversation too far off in a tangent, but this idea of observing and understanding and interacting and being constantly connected to the natural world as we advance in our technology is helpful in ways that people might not immediately think of. So for example, Raytheon is a company that is building robots to send other planets. And when they started building these, they started building them around a human intelligence, how humans might approach doing that. What they found is that octopus intelligence might be the best artificial intelligence to put into those robots. And they only came to that conclusion because they were observant and they paid attention and they were thinking outside the box.
This is totally why you get invited back.
Try to bring my best game.
That's amazing. Okay, well, let's turn the conversation on its head a little. I have some more to read here. And Peter from Rochester called in, didn't want to stay on, just wanted to make a remark. Peter, I wish you'd stayed on. I'm told he was quite agitated. He says that he doesn't even understand why we're having this conversation. He said this is a very suspect conversation, and really, farming does not have a future. We just need to be realistic about that. He says Bloomberg wasn't calling farmers dumb, and the farmers here just got their feelings hurt. I don't know why Peter thinks farming doesn't have a future. I'm not exactly sure where he thinks food's going to come from. And I don't mean to be like sort of flip about that. Peter, I wish you had stayed on the line because that part of the remark I don't get. Farming doesn't have a future. Maybe he's talking, Chris Mizik, about automation taking jobs away. I mean, sort of similar to what Bloomberg might have been saying. I don't know. But you want to address some of those remarks? Go ahead.
I mean, who knows, right? Bloomberg's sprinkling money out everywhere all over this country right now. My best guess was Peter's a paid shill. But at the end of the day, what he may be talking about is being more productive, trying to get more crops out of, you know, less acreage. But that's going to impact the environment. And we need to be cognizant of the negative environmental implications that may have as well.
Okay. By the way, I have no evidence he's a paid shill, but Peter, you can call back if you want to address that. Go ahead, Matt Kelly.
Well, you know, the other part of Peter's statement I'd like to address is the fact that we got our feelings hurt, which I'm not sure is entirely true. I mean, I know we've gone through all the tissues here in the studio having this conversation.
I don't hear actually any hurt feelings.
Yeah, you know, and I hear that comment a lot, in discussions like this, and it really frustrates me as much as Bloomberg's comments frustrated me. Just because we are discussing something that...
Of substance
that a presidential candidate said, which perpetuates a completely misinformed and misunderstood perspective of the world, does not mean our feelings are hurt.
Exactly.
It means we're trying to push back against this perception that can have profound impacts on how we move our society forward. My feelings aren't hurt. I'm just frustrated as hell.
Mm-hmm. But do you think farming has no future, as Peter said? I'm trying to figure out what that's based on.
I don't even know how to respond to that. Yeah. Yes, it has a future. We need to eat.
Yeah, eating is good.
Eating is good.
I'm a big fan. Ruth?
I don't know. Maybe he photosynthesizes? Does he just breathe air? I don't know. I'd like to thank Peter for just proving our point from before that there really is this giant gap in understanding between sort of the intellectual, what some people like to call the elites. I don't really believe in that term, but people who just don't have any connection at all to where their food comes from and don't have an understanding about the life that farmers lead and the kinds of things that they're thinking about and doing. I think that's a big problem in this country. I know it's a problem for me personally, for my business. I'm always trying to educate my members. That's sort of part of what being a CSA is about.
But briefly, Ruth, on that subject.
Yeah.
Alex says, I've heard people like Peter, they're sometimes referring to the idea that family or small farms are going away, and the only way we can feed 10 billion people is to move to industrial farming. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, a lot of the industrial farming, even in this state, is mostly just growing commodity crops that are subsidized by the government. So they're growing corn, wheat, and soy. The corn they're growing and the soy they're growing aren't even really being eaten by people. They're being fed to livestock. Hmm. So, I mean, a lot of the varied vegetables and fruit you're eating are being farmed by people. A lot of them are Mexicans in California, but right now there's not really a way to automate a lot of that. Maybe there will be in the future. But I can see that still being done by hand for a very long time.
All right, Matt, you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to start making excuses and rationalizing Peter's statement. You know, if you're going to make a statement like that, you better be prepared to stand by it, right? So, but what I think is, and this is what I would go back, I think Peter's statement is very similar to Bloomberg's statement in that if you were trying to say something else, and if you were trying to convey a deeper nuance about the conversation here, that's great. You could have done it in a completely different way, in the same amount of time, with the same or better impact.
Fair enough. Okay. You want to add anything there, Chris?
No, I Matt summed it up perfectly there. You know, we're in this time where people just like to throw arrows. They like to throw out little jabs. The thing about farming is it requires dignity. And I want to see that back in our public discourse.
All right. Let's get Vincent in Naples next on the phone. Go ahead, Vincent. Hi, Vincent.
Kind of 2 points. Hi. 1 point on Peter's comment. I think maybe Peter was talking about a time in the future when food and sustenance is, for example, in pill form. So there's a rhetorical comment or a rhetorical understanding there. And I had a conversation with a cousin of mine who works for a startup in California, living a very different lifestyle than I live in the Finger Lakes on a small homestead, trying to grow my own food. And in his world, it was better if we could all just survive off pills and he could be working to make the world better. He thought that was more productive. Like, wouldn't it be more productive if I could just eat a pill or two people could farm for millions and the rest of us could be more productive? And it made me think, like, but I really enjoy the value behind being outside, having my hands in the soil, spending time in the sunshine, being exposed to the elements, that productivity, if we base all our decisions around how am I being productive right now, then we end up in this, where the space where we are, people are depressed and angry and frustrated and don't know, I don't know, there's value to farming and being connected to where your food comes from that's not economical. And then just, I'm sorry, just the other point was that we need leadership like Bloomberg to understand that, that real food, that sustainable food, that good food, it's not just expensive, it's value. Like real food has real value. And whenever we have these conversations around food, they come back to this income inequality, wealth inequality. We don't have an equal distribution, equitable distribution of wealth in our country. And that means how are we going to sustainably and equitably feed people when the wealth that is needed for that food that has real value is not distributed among our population equitably. And so I think it comes back to some of the conversations that we're seeing right now around basic universal income. And what is the dignity behind farming, the dignity of a person? Does automation, I think that conversation of fearing automation is, it's most in capitalism where we're like, oh my gosh, if a machine did my job, the only reason to fear that is because how do you get money then? And if we distributed our wealth more equitably, that wasn't based around, it didn't try to put value on a person based on their skills and what they did, if it valued them just as being a human, we wouldn't have to fear automation as much. So I know that was a lot. I'm sorry to throw that all out there, but your conversation's really got me thinking.
All right, Vincent, thank you. No, I appreciate that. And I'll let our guests kind of offer their thoughts. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, I hope Soylent Green isn't in our future. And that would...
Though it's interesting. Are you familiar with a project called Soylent?
No.
So Soylent Green is from the movie. Soylent is it's not a pill. It's a powder. That I think some tech guys in San Francisco, they wanted to kind of streamline what they had to eat, and food cost a lot of their budget. So they created this powder form product that's supposed to have all the nutrients you need in a day, and they called it Soylent. And the New York Times, by the way, got a sommelier to test it.
Okay.
And it was sort of gross. And it hasn't made a mint, I don't think, but I could be wrong. But anyway, to your point, yeah. People are still, Ruth is dying over here. The point is, people are, I guess they're trying to find that future. I don't know if we're going there.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I like to talk about with regards to agriculture, winemaking, farming, is the community aspect. And if what we're talking about now is removing food as one of our sort of community experiences, and we're talking about no more restaurants and those service jobs, I mean, you are painting a picture of a dystopian nightmare in a place I don't want to live. So I would much rather know my farmer. I would much rather enjoy the wines from the hands of people I know that made it. I would love to go out to good local restaurants that are making food from good local produce. So, and have that community aspect and have that relationship. You know, I'm sure there will be some folks who make the decision that all they need comes in a pill or a powder. But productivity with regard to the human experience is not everything.
Yeah, and so, Matt, to kind of piggyback on that point, if we have income inequality at strong, high levels like we do in certain parts of our world, including parts of this country, if the argument is, well, in the future, we can just get pills and powders, and that'll streamline things, I think that's a little bit given up on creating a little bit more of an egalitarian world where people can afford to support their farmers. Because I understand there are some listeners going, I can't afford a CSA. I mean, Ruth would love everybody listening to join Mud Creek Farm CSA, like right now. I'm riffing, but that's probably true, isn't it?
Not everyone.
That'd probably overwhelm you.
people who like to eat a lot of different kinds of vegetables and want to get it locally, and actually more, I mean, I've regularly taken one of my shares and priced it against what you would pay at Wegmans in the organic produce section for the same amount and same kinds of food. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite consistently giving out things for about half the price of what you would spend in Wegmans, because I don't have to spend a lot of money having it shipped across the country. So there's economic pros to eating local too.
All right, I realize this is not why you're here, but is your CSA open for sign up right now?
Yes, mudcreekfarm.com.
Okay.
The info you need is there.
Hey, since they're all here, I mean, you can find Belangelo Wines on Seneca Lake and just about anywhere wine is sold. And Matt Kelly has a new podcast. Look at all these farmers doing smart things. You have a new podcast out.
I do, and it didn't take much gray matter at all to do it.
I bet you it did, actually. The Bee Report podcast.
The Bee Report podcast, that's correct.
Okay, and so, but back to the subject at hand here. If we have inequality, I mean, the solution in the future strikes me as, I'm kind of with Chris here. I don't really want a world where there's no farms or restaurants and everything is sort of in pills and powders. Maybe that's where some people want to go.
Well, and I think, you know, what strikes me about the real issue with thinking about our future is the issue with these San Francisco tech titans who just want to, like, eat protein shakes so that they can work, like, 25 hours a day. That's great if they want to do that. And I have to say, you know, given the lifestyle that we have as farmers, we also know how valuable it is to, like, scarf food down as quickly as you can to get on to the next thing. So it's hard for me to begrudge somebody who wants to accomplish that. The problem I have with so many of the conversations about where we should go is they're very just singular, monolithic visions about how everybody should do what I think is the right thing to do. Right? I mean, part of the issue with food inequality and income inequality is the lack of choices people have. And I think we want to create a future where we have choices, where all of us are empowered to make the choices that are best for us. So if some dude in Silicon Valley wants to pop pills and eat protein shakes and that's all the only way he gets his nutrients, great. Dude, do it. But that should not be the vision for all of us. And I think that's where, and again, bigger picture, I think this is where so much of the technology we have and that we can build into will allow far greater freedom of choice to make these lifestyle choices if we do it thoughtfully and effectively.
That's a great point. Because some people may want those pills and powders, and that works for you, it works for you. But sort of saying that that's the charting the course for everyone, I don't know. Susan writes to say, thanks for giving us a show on how farming is a difficult, highly demanding gray matter employment. But to base this as an anti-Bloomberg comment show, I feel you should do your homework and listen to the entire original discussion Mr. Bloomberg had. Out of context doesn't begin to describe my frustration at the basis of your presentation. Bloomberg's comments were about history, from moving from hunter-gatherers to agrarian society, to plant a seed and let it grow, to the industrial society, and now the highly technical society we have. After I did my homework and listened to the entirety of the interview, I don't believe he was comparing farmers of an agrarian society to the farmers of today, or of even the last recent centuries. Susan says, you're taking these out of context comments just to increase ratings. We don't really do ratings. We know what they are. They're really good. but Susan, I said earlier, the Bloomberg campaign agrees with you that we are out of context here, and that the commentary this hour, the Bloomberg campaign would say, is unfair, that he was making a point about where work is going. My take on that is, I think he was trying to make a comment about where work is going, similar to the points you made. I also think he demonstrated a sort of naivete about farming even hundreds of years ago, probably reflects a naivete about how physical labor matters and what is required of it today. And frankly, I think that disconnection with labor matters in political leaders. But the Bloomberg campaign agrees with you, Susan, and I'm not here trying to crank ratings, but I did want to talk to farmers who, by the way, come from different backgrounds themselves. So I appreciate that email. But Matt, are you swayed? Do you think that we're way out of context and unfair here?
No. In fact, I have to say, before coming on the show, I made sure to read up on the context.
Absolutely.
Of this. You know, I was not interested in doing just criticism of Bloomberg. What I'm interested in is addressing the mindset and the perspective that seems to be encapsulated in this one snippet. No other context, no matter how generous or charitable or egalitarian it might be, changes the fact that this gives us insight into how a current presidential candidate thinks about things. And that's what we're addressing.
Fair. Chris?
Yeah, I think people understand that, one, he is an elite. I'm with you, whatever that means, but it means something. He's the elite of the elite, and he doesn't understand working people. What he said isn't raising a ruckus because he said it. It's because it's resonating with people, and it's making them feel like the dignity of their work doesn't matter. That's why people are upset. We're trying to make sure that the whole society knows what we do as working class folks, as farmers, matters.
His description of farming, Ruth, even hundreds of years ago, didn't strike me as very sophisticated.
No. And I mean, I also looked up the whole clip and sort of looked up his campaign policies and where he's at. I personally, I mean, my biggest issue in the coming election is a climate issue. And I think he really made a mistake with this comment, because He really showed that he is probably going to lose a lot of the working class voters out there with this. I mean, it's basically Clinton's deplorable comment. This is his deplorables. I think we really need a Democratic, someone on the Democratic side who's running against Trump who can reach people who are working class, somebody who understands what the working class in this country, where they're coming from.
Well, and so as we close the hour, I mean, I don't think I've gotten this many emails about a single topic in months. I mean, I could just read email all day, and if I didn't get to yours, I apologize. We're just buried in it. So a lot of strong response to Mr. Bloomberg's comments, and so I think at least he'll probably be asked about that at the upcoming debate, of which he is now a part because he's qualified. Because he's rising in the polls and spent $500 million. I want to thank our guests for being here. Ruth Blackwell, you can find her at Mud Creek Farm CSA. Online where?
At mudcreekfarm.com. We're also having a CSA fair at Abundance. Abundance Food Co-op, Saturday, March 21st, if you want to talk to other CSA farmers or me.
All right. TheBReport.com for Matt Kelly. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Online where? Chris Misick with Belangelo.
Belangelo.com.
Thanks for being here. More connections coming up.